is in the matter of the welfare of the children of SC and JJAL, court file A20-1113. The matter is here for oral argument via Zoom conference, but all the normal rules of the Court of Appeals apply, meaning each counsel will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording the proceedings in our normal course of business, and we will post that recording. So it would help us greatly if you would identify yourselves for the record as you begin your arguments. With that, we'll begin. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Shane Baker, Candiotti County Attorney, appearing for appellant. The two basic issues before the court revolve around those involving the factual findings involving the trial itself and the asserted due process violation claims. I've covered a few of these appeals for child protection cases, and it's the unique position of appearing as an appellant as opposed to a respondent. That history on representation knows that there is this higher level that's needed to reverse a district court decision in a child protection matter. The findings of fact, the standard of review is whether they're supported by substantial evidence and are not clearly erroneous. And a finding is clearly erroneous if it is either manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. And the trial court's findings of fact only if upon review of the entire record, the court's left with a definite firm conviction that a mistake has been made should be reversed. We also must show that it's prejudicial. I start out with the standard of review because I understand that we have to do more than just relitigate our case. Our brief cites to a number of fact findings. We believe the court made that were clear error. But I want to point out three of them because I think they permeate all the issues here and are key on the issue of prejudice. First is the finding regarding Dr. Hudson, the trial court's findings that Dr. Hudson did not find that these injuries were abusive. Second, related to the right rib fractures. And third, were the findings regarding access to the child. First on Dr. Hudson's findings. The court asserted that he did not testify that the harm was non-accidental. That's at findings 11 of the court's. And it also said, or the judge said, if he felt medically certain that this was an inflicted injury, he didn't say so. These findings are clearly erroneous. Dr. Hudson testified that it was his medical conclusion that the fractures on the child's ribs were abusive trauma. Specifically, the testimony was with the question on page 190, the fractures on the ribs and the hand, your medical conclusion is abusive trauma. His answer was yes. Then specifically asked, are you providing your opinion, a medical certainty that there was abuse? And the doctor said that would be my medical diagnosis, correct? He also said the cause of the injuries to the child is inflicted or abusive trauma. The
Mr.
brief cites.
Baker, when yeah. I read all of the judge's order and the orders that preceded it, I don't think that she is saying that it wasn't inflicted abusive trauma. I think she's just saying that the county didn't prove that the parents knew who did it or that they did it themselves. I think that's the gist of her order.
That's why it was important to cite to those specific findings of the court where it did say that the doctor did not find that it was abusive trauma. The judge also goes on to say about proof, but I think that's where it goes into effect. The judge's overall decision is premised on finding that it was not abusive trauma.
Well, I think it goes to her emphasis on access to the child.
And let me skip to that because I think that's important too, because that finding is also clearly erroneous. The brief cites specifically to the page transcripts where the parents themselves said they were the only ones who had access to the children, that there was no one else who had access alone to the child. So the parents' own testimony refutes the access issue. Then the third finding dealt with the right rib.
And you're talking about rib number 8. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that is correct. That's outlined in my brief where Dr. Hudson testifies that rib number 8, the right on the back, was widening and healing fractures. Now these specific issues are important because for Dr. Hudson, and finding that he didn't see him as abusive trauma goes into issues on the EPC and the judge feeling like the county had mischaracterized it in their EPC affidavit when the court said we had not showed by any quantum of proof, let alone proved by clear and convincing evidence, the egregious harm. So that finding clearly links to that issue. The right rib, that's key because of the MLA decision. That's a Court of Appeals decision. It's unpublished. It came shortly after the TB decision from the Supreme Court, where it talked about this new or should have known standard. And the court in that case, it was a similar situation here where there's rib injuries and there were healing injuries. And the Court of Appeals had no problem finding that met the TP standard of new or should have known. So if erroneous finding on the right rib as being a healing fracture goes to the overall issue of proving by clear and convincing evidence the newer should have known standard announced in TP.
I have two questions. One is outside of the record, but I'm just curious where these children are now.
They're on a trial home visit.
And then my second, and so actually I have three questions. The second one is, I know that in egregious harm cases, that the court can relieve the Department of Reasonable Efforts. It's not for the department to decide whether or not they're going to be relieved of reasonable efforts. My understanding, at least from my 7 years in juvenile court in Hennepin County, was that the district court had to relieve the department. I didn't see anywhere in the record where this district court judge relieved the county agency of reasonable efforts. Can you point me to any place in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. And of course, the court's talking about 260.012, and that's based on a prima facie finding. And that needs to be done early on in the case. So I guess that's always been does it need to be a relieved of efforts since it's a prima facie finding? I don't know how the matter proceeds forward if there's not a prima facie finding on an allegation the county's making. As to where in the record,
because certainly the judge continued to order expanded visitation, those sorts of things, which seems to run counter to an argument that she relieved the Department of Reasonable Efforts.
I'm looking at two transcripts. One is from the admit deny hearing of April 23rd, 2020.
Okay. So that's the admit deny in the TPR.
Correct.
Okay.
And then the father's attorney, Thomas Kramer, refers to the county having been relieved of efforts in the transcript dated June 11th, 2020.
Well, but that's the attorney speaking. That's not the judge speaking.
No, I know. I was providing the court locations in the record where I saw the issue of reasonable efforts being relieved, I identified.
And so then my third question has to do with due process. And I did a search of the transcript and the record looking for that phrase, due process. And the first place that it came up was in August of 2020 after the trial. Is that your recollection too?
That is my recollection, Your Honor. And that is some of our claim is that throughout this process, none of the parties ever claimed that the county was engaging in due process violations. This was all the court after the trial was said and done. And there were multiple hearings in the initial CHIPS hearing and into the TPR itself.
And I'll ask Mr. Cardle about that too, because his brief focused on the merits of the judge's decision to dismiss the TPR, and he didn't really address the due process. Seems that his clients are more interested in having their children home, but I'll ask him about that when it's his turn.
The issue of access, why I identify that as a third critical finding of fact is because by focusing on that the issue is access versus the child being in the parent's care, the court is adding elements to what the county has to prove to establish a TPR factor. The issue is not whether others are excluded as having access, it's whether the child suffers egregious harm in the parent's care.
So Mr. Baker, let me ask you this question. It's kind of a broader question. I understand your arguments from your brief as to your claims of factual error that the court made in the case, but our overarching standard of review here is whether the court abused its discretion in either granting or denying termination petition by finding no statutory basis was proved. And we, as an appellate court, don't make credibility determinations. We defer to the district court on credibility determinations. And here, the district court found the parents' explanation that they didn't do this harm and didn't know who did credible, and also found credible testimony from Dr. Oppoven that there could have been other causes of this injury. Again, we're not weighing credibility here. So how has, even if we agree with you in all or in part, that some of the court's factual findings perhaps weren't supported by the record, how has the court, in making these credibility determinations, abused its discretion in denying the county's petition?
I would say it's one, based on this erroneous standard that the county had to establish, that we had to disprove that others had access. So it's using the wrong legal standard to make its decision. Two, with regards to Dr. Oppoven, she never testified that specific things were the cause of the injury. She gave possibilities that, you know, it could have been the slightly older sibling. She didn't say like the parents' other experts' testimony that the injuries were from this. And then the judge discounted all those other experts. And then with the findings missing that the judge, Dr. Hudson, said these were abusive, that leaves this error where it's seen that that doctor did not find that there were abusive injuries, using an erroneous legal burden, and then discounting all other evidence. I think that's where you get to the abusive discretion.
It seems that another factor that the district court considered was that these parents are unlike most of the parents that I saw either in juvenile court or read about at the Court of Appeals, in that they followed their case plan. They were never late for visits. They made every visit. They were attentive. They did the evaluations. They did all of the things, except for the genetic testing that the department asked them to do. they worked hard to reunify with their children. And that seemed to weigh into the judge's broad discretion when she made her decision.
No, that's certainly a part of it. It's, I just go back to my other answer in that to exercise it, because the statute does say may terminate. It doesn't require it, even if the factor is found. But if adding on top of the clear error on the state's key or the county's key evidence on what the abuse was from, requiring a different standard, how does a court exercise discretion on that ultimate TPR if it's getting the rest of it wrong? I see my time's up. I'll may have to address the other arguments in the next section.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cardall, I see you're muted and you may proceed when you're ready. Hold on 1 second. Okay, clock's ready. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Eric Cardall, representing the respondents. With respect to the high standards of proof, we don't have a disagreement with the county. They're citing the right statutes and the right cases. It's a very high standard to reverse, as the county has indicated. Of course, I think the court, one of the questioners was correct that that the father's and mother's testimony, their performance to reunify the family, was taken into account by the judge. But it seemed like the biggest event in the proceeding was the judge handling the evidence regarding Dr. Hudson and Dr. Oppoven. And, you know, Dr. Hudson's approach was, you know, there was science here supporting that this was an abusive trauma. The court agreed that there was that according to Dr. Hudson and the others, that there was acute fractures that occurred in a 7 to 10 day window prior to the September 22 visit. So he was convinced of that. But then Dr. Hudson went further with the idea that it was a violent squeeze caused it and so forth. And so what Dr. Oppoven was saying was, as a forensic pediatric pathologist, that when you're relying on science to prove a conclusion, you have to consider, and this is a big phrase, I'm sorry, alternative investigative hypotheses. And so alternative investigative hypotheses are part of the scientific method. And it's something that judges do all the time. The judges are saying, is there an alternative explanation? And so I think when the judge chose to follow Dr. Oppoven's path, it was because Dr. Oppoven was a better witness. Having that forensic background, Dr. Oppoven was showing, look, there are alternative investigative hypotheses that were not investigated by Dr. Hudson and not investigated by the county. And so when the judge was critical of the county, for example, on page A111, if following Dr. Oppoven's, here's what the expert should have done, follows through 6-7 alternative investigative hypotheses, the judge says, this is the analysis the court expects the county and a child's medical professionals to undertake when there are unexplained bone abnormalities or fractures in a young infant. So there's a realization here by the judge that these are difficult cases, very, very difficult, and that we need to look at all alternative investigative hypotheses before making a scientific conclusion that the parent did it. You know, and so here, you know, this is ordinary stuff for a court to deal with, you know, like a criminal setting, right? Who did it, right? Now, it's a different standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Here is clear and convincing evidence, both high standards. And so the judge, based on the testimony of the parents, and based on Dr. Oppoven showing that Dr. Hudson's testimony was insufficient scientifically to come to some of the conclusions he made, like that it was a result of a violent squeezing, whereas Dr. Oppoven said, well, that could have been the 3-year falling on the child or 2-year-old at the time. So the point that the reason why the county failed to meet the mark with the clear and convincing standard was the county didn't investigate alternative hypotheses with respect to access. The judge said simple examination of x-rays, even by multiple pediatric radiologists, is insufficient when it comes to an acute fracture in a young infant. then with respect to the bone strength issue, the judge concluded further inquiry into bone strength was warranted due to the mother's vitamin D deficiency during pregnancy. Also, I must note that, you know, IC could have caused the injury to VC. The child abuse literature was referenced by Dr. Oppoven that this is fairly common and there's sibling jealousy. Dr. Oppoven also then provides an explanation, as opposed to Dr. Hudson, that violent squeezing did it. You know how pejorative that is, violent squeezing, as opposed to another child falling on the child. So how would a doctor reviewing the x-rays know that how that happened? And the judge even was so careful, and I thought this was sort of amazing, that the judge explained that on 922, with the IC moving around VC, that it could have been the movement that was causing the pain. The accident might have occurred earlier. And so in light of that high, clear, and convincing standard, I think the judge did very good work in analyzing the evidence in a way that we would want. It was very thorough. And on this point of alternative investigative hypotheses that weren't considered by Dr. Hudson, it seems to be the critical juncture. Once the judge had the testimony from the parents, and then Dr. Oppoven's testimony, saw that the county had fallen far short. The other evidence that have already been mentioned in some of the questions, but the judge referenced family time and how the parents were interacting with the children, the parenting skills, the anger assessment, the individual therapy, the best interest of the children, and then the county had failed in reasonable efforts to reunite the family, or at least to the judge's desire. And then in the end, the judge even said, look, I know that I'm the only one stopping these parents from having their rights terminated. And I'm concerned that once Dr. Hudson's opinion was obtained, then you had confirmation bias. In other words, everyone just said, well, we got the expert, let's run with that. But yet these are practical evidentiary questions that every county attorney and prosecutor deal with. You know, who caused the harm to the child? Who knew who caused the harm to the child? And those are the things that need to be addressed in the county's presentation. I think that leads then to the judge's concern about how the county and DHS have been working. I think the judge's concern was about the children. And so the judge was just like, wow, I was involved in this. I was the last person. If I had just gone along with it, the parents' rights would have been terminated. And there wasn't evidence for that. And so the judge was concerned. So when we read 4A, B, and C of that order, the judge is concerned about, well, are you just upping this up to TPR, termination of parental rights petition, because the permanency timelines are passing? Are you sure you have objective processes for safety plans in difficult and extraordinary circumstances? Because there should have been one here. And then lastly, do you understand this idea of alternative investigative hypotheses? In other words, are you investigating other potential causes of harm, or are you being sympathetic? This is particularly important to the judge because at the initial proceedings, if you care about children, which she does, obviously, at the initial proceedings, the court relies on, at the admit-deny hearing and at the EPC hearing, on the government doing a good job. And so that's really important that the government have good procedures up front, because for the children, I'm not talking about parents, but for the children, the separation from the parents can be traumatic. And so she's, the judge is very concerned about the children. The judge was trying in the order, right or wrong, the judge was trying the order to wake up the county and the county's attorney's office that these sort of fundamentals of evidence, like researching alternative investigative hypotheses, is really critical early in the process, so we don't have situations where children end up separated from their parents unnecessarily, or caregivers. I should say caregivers, I'm sorry. the children aren't separated from their guardian or caregiver or parent unnecessarily. And so I would encourage the court to sympathize with the judge in reading the order regarding the directions to the county and the county attorney's office, because I think the judge was just trying to help. I don't think the judge, I mean, you look at, it says order, it does say order, I agree. But what the judge is trying to do is draw the county attorney's attention and the Child Protection Services attention to this idea that let the evidence lead you to your petition that you're gonna file. Don't jump ahead of the evidence. Don't consider that passing the permanency timeline is a cause to make a decision. You know, and those sort of things. So I believe that the judge did a tremendous job in analyzing the evidence and was correct that the county had fallen far short because it didn't do an investigation that would lead to the type of evidence that would meet the high standard.
So, Mr. Cardall, where I think you lose me on that argument is that what you indicated, this wasn't a kind suggestion by the court in the TPR order that here's what could have been done better and here's why I think you failed. This was a directive of the court to do this with the Department of Human Services to correct the deficiencies in your departments. And there, as Judge Riley pointed out, there was no notice to anyone that the court was going to go down that path. And so I think that's what implicates the due process concerns, that no one had the basic opportunity to address what the court felt were the shortcomings in the matter. And I think the court went further than it arguably could by directing the matter as an order under those circumstances, as opposed to including that as part of its TPR order as to here's why the proof fails, in my view.
There's a problem with the court order in the idea that it orders the county and the county attorney to do these things. It may have been better like a suggestion. It could have even been a letter of some sort. And so I understand the county's angst about that. Isn't in the ordinary course.
And she also ordered the Minnesota Department of Human Services to do things, and they're not a party. So I don't know where that jurisdiction comes from.
That's right. And so the... So there's a line there that may have been crossed, I think the better interpretation of the court order is that it has no legal effect, and that it's a suggestion. I think that the idea that the judge had was that the judge was trying to help, and the judge may have crossed a line by using those words, and maybe with that, with respect to that, it would be more of a suggestion. As she should have said, I suggest these things rather than order them. Because ostensibly, I think the court's concern is if these orders aren't followed, then there possibly be civil contempt or whatever. And so if we lower it from order to suggestion, then because we do want, I think, witnesses in the judicial process, particularly in this area, to state what they see, because there's a lot of cooperation between the Department of Human Services and the courts, and the court knows that it's all over the place, and that's a good thing. But if we see things that are wrong, then we want witnesses, be the judges, judicial employees, attorneys representing any side. We want people to say, hey, there's something wrong. And unnecessary out-of-home placements, that's a type of wrong. I mean, we need Child Protection Services to help us reduce child abuse, but we also need to avoid unnecessary out-of-home placements. And so I think here that was the judge's concern, but it should have been probably a suggestion rather than an order because of the invocation of contempt powers. And that's, of course, why the county appealed. So I understand that. On a bigger note, and this is common, there are some really big issues in this case, but my clients just care about having the children back. And so we were glad to pick up that issue. But are my clients concerned, as shown with their performance and trying to reunify the family and even the efforts here today, that's their focus, is their children. And they would like to cooperate with the county in any way they can, but they don't want to get on the other side of the county on this issue. That's much bigger than their agenda. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Cardall. Mr. Baker, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you. The brief outlines a lot of our arguments regarding that second issues on the due process. Let me just highlight some of those points. As has been stated, it wasn't just a mere suggestion or, you know, we were told we had to do it. And that was pretty clear by inviting all the parties to the, we were ordered to appear at the dispositional and reveal of the decision on August 10th, along with every social worker in the department and all guardian ad litems in the 8th Judicial District.
Are you saying the entire department was present at that hearing?
All social workers and child protection, all my attorneys and me, were required to be there, and all guardians of the 8th Judicial District.
And that was the judge's, that was the district court's order?
Yes.
Did Mr. McCabe retire or move on?
He took a job in South Dakota. On some of these issues, the prejudging the case, thinking that we rushed a judgment, I find it hard to say how can we prejudge the case and rush to judgment if we didn't file the TPR right out the gate, because we had authority to, on an egregious harm, not to file a CHIPS, to go immediately to the bypass TPR. We didn't do that. We were looking for other evidence, the second skeletal genetic information. We were actively seeking that. As Judge Riley pointed out, it was the parents cooperate with all the expectations except for that testing. We were actively seeking that, because that would matter to me too. I dealt with an older case, I think it's DLT, about a year and a half before this one, where it was egregious harm, broken bones. And you wanna know if there's some other cause. And finding all that information does take time. So I don't know how we, on one hand, prejudge the case, but then we're not filing that TPR petition within 30 days as the court's order talks about. You know, so that's an issue that I have on that point. And
let me ask you this, and Mr. Cardall pointed to paragraphs 4A through C of the order from August 11th. What are you asking us to do with regard to those paragraphs? And that's where your office and the Candy Yohai Human Services will work together and involve Minnesota Department of Health of Human Services.
I guess I'm looking for an opinion where it says that that order was invalid outside the scope of the authority for the reasons highlighted in the brief, and then vacate that part of the court's order. I think, and I did put that block quote, or my assistant did, on, it came up during the investigation of one of their experts, where the court on its own decided to go check into the background of this person. And it's within the quote about believing they're empowered under the pilot project. What that is the Supreme Court set up a program in Canada County and surrounding counties about 4 years ago, where we'd have a single judge handling these cases, as opposed to multiple judges, multiple counties. And I think it's within that concern where the court isn't empowered to do the independent investigation. It's not empowered to if it sees problems, issue these directives to the agency. There's findings in there about how I'm not communicating, or my office is not communicating with our human services department. There's certainly nothing in the record about that. I mean, I've been meeting with them for 4 years, roughly 18 times a year with their supervisors. I know that's not on the record, but likewise that we don't communicate is not in the record either. You know, so there are limits, and that's what the other part of the brief talks about is you can call attention, as Mr. Cardell was saying these are things we see as problems. The judges, you said that too, but to go and the step of ordering it and mandating it, that there's lack of authority on that issue. The judge cited to DF. It's not with it. In that case, the court was seeking to reverse a termination decision. Like here, it would be for the court to find we didn't meet our evidence, here's why, but not to order these extraneous things. I see my time's up. If there's any questions. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
I see there's none, and I thank counsel for your briefing and arguments in the matter here today. The matter is submitted to this court, and we'll take it under advisement, and we will issue a decision within the statutory period. We stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.